as well as being a good professional doctor, that's got a certain clout in our culture. There's also a book by Christopher Lash called The Culture of Narcissism. And what he's after in that book is the idea that what's really going on in our culture is one long episode of self-indulgence. That people are working so hard trying to love themselves and trying to express themselves and authenticate themselves. Robert Bella and a group of colleagues wrote a book called Habits of the Heart. And in that book, there's a little famous vignette which ends up with Sheila-ism. And that's really their way of talking about how individuals finally can't relate to all of the big isms that are out there. And so they create a little one of their own. And so the only thing that really matters is Sheila's little world. She creates a little cocoon of her own and kind of tries to screen the rest of the world out. Now, we're not going to talk about all of those at great length this morning at all, but I just want to kind of lift those up as signals of pain. What they're telling us is that people have lost their sense of purpose. And so they're kind of almost frantic trying to find one, trying to realize themselves. There's unending pressure in our culture. It's a good American thing to do to make something of yourself. And it's like we have a job to kind of construct ourselves. And we keep at it, we keep working at it. There's problems of meaninglessness, and there is the whole problem of American individualism. All of these seem to me to be signs that people do not have a sense of vocation. All right, so that's one of the reasons why I thought I'd want to talk to you about this idea called vocation. The other one is a very different kind of reason, and that is a long time ago, Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon seized upon an idea that they thought had real value for freeing people. And it was the idea of vocation. I'm just going to read one short quotation. It's the only long quotation I will have in the entire time we're together. It comes from the Augsburg Confession, Article 26. So this comes right from the heart of the Lutheran Reformation. And what I want you to listen for as I read this quotation is how important it was for the early reformers to be clear about the value of having a vocation. Melanchthon writes, "Traditions were exalted far above the commands of God. Christianity was thought to consist wholly in the observance of certain holy days, rites, fasts, and vestments. Such observances claimed for themselves the glamorous title of comprising the spiritual life and the perfect life. Meanwhile, the commands of God pertaining to callings," you could read that word as vocation, "the commands of God pertaining to callings were without honor. For example," now remember, this is a 16th century quotation, and so there's a different understanding of the relationship of gender and power than ones that we operate today, but let me read it as it was written. "For example, that a father should bring up his children, that a mother should bear children, that a prince should govern his country. These were regarded as secular works, as secular and imperfect works, far inferior to those glittering observances." Now here comes the judgment on all of that. "This error greatly tormented the consciences of devout people who grieved that they were bound to an imperfect kind of life, in marriage, in the magistracy, or in other civil occupations, and admired the monks and others like them falsely imagining that the observances of such people, of such men in this case, were more pleasing to God. So there was a little signal there in the Augsburg Confession that I want to take very seriously, that something ultimate is at stake in this idea of vocation. I want to explore that a little bit with you. And here's how I propose that we set out on the journey. Today, I want to think with you about what it would mean to organize life around the forgiveness of sins. What would that look like? The second session on Wednesday, I'm going to try to focus our conversation on the relationship of the idea of vocation to the world of work. And I have a case study which I will distribute to anybody who wants to do some reading today. It's a short one that lifts up an aspect of the world of work for us to think about. The third session is going to deal with something that Americans don't like, institutions. And we are going to think about the relationship of vocation to the institutions which shape our lives. And again, I have a case study that we will look at. And finally, session four, which is on Friday, I'm going to show you a video of a PBS film called Faith Under Fire. And this film raises the question of what's the vocation of the Christian vis-a-vis the big powers, the state. And the way they do it is they focus, again it's a case study, on the changes in Czechoslovakia and Poland and the role of the church and of confessing Christians in all of that. So that's the trajectory that we're going to pursue. Now that doesn't exhaust the riches of the idea of vocation, but at least it lifts up different aspects of us of the idea for us to think about. My question in all of this, and I want to hear this from you, is how far can this idea of vocation really take us? Just how good an idea is this really? And I hope we can really have some interchange about that. Now, let me sketch for you what I think is the core idea through all of the discussions that we're going to have. And this is a quotation from a theologian who wrote in 1909 a little book which has been translated and called Our Calling. The heart of this book is this sentence. My call is the form my life takes according as God organizes it through God's forgiving, as God organizes it for me through God's forgiving grace. Let me read that again. My call, my vocation, is the form my life takes according as God organizes it for me through God's forgiving grace. Now, the shorter version of that is this sentence. Life organized around the forgiveness of sins. And that's what we're going to explore today, and I'm going to come at that in two ways. First, I'm going to give you some questions to think about, and then we're going to explore a text. These are questions that I think we'll think about just a bit while we're together, but they're actually more questions for when you're on the trail, or when you're at the loom, or when you're at the potter's wheel. Things to kind of just ruminate about as you're doing all the other things you do. Here's question one. This is the hardest one, I think, to answer. One. What is your vocation? Now, you don't have to accept the definition that I just put on the table, but I would ask, as you answer it, that you begin to think about, well, where am I getting kind of the focusing principle that helps me answer that question? What is your vocation? See, I don't think you can answer that in the next 5 minutes. I think you've got to spend at least a week or a couple weeks on it. Number two, look backward over your life. Is there a thread in your life? Another way to put that is there a plot in your life? You know, plots have a beginning and a middle and an end. Does your life have a beginning? Are you moving towards the middle? Are you approaching the end? What's running through all of that that links it all together? A good book has a great plot. A good life has a great plot. Or another way to say it is there a direction to your life? Where are you heading? Or where have you been heading as you look back? It's kind of like when you walk up a trail, you turn around and look where you've been coming from. You begin to spot that there is a shape or a direction to it. Or to use Al Pitcher's phrase from this morning in Madness, is there a focus in your life? Can you find a central focus? Okay, question three, and really this is another way, all of these are sort of trying to just unravel this idea of vocation a bit. There are different ways to come at it. Is there a shape to your life? I didn't ask what kind of shape you're in, but I guess we could ask it that way too. And again, there's a number of ways that we could approach that question. Let me give you just one example. These are a couple of ideas from a psychiatrist named Robert Lifton. He makes some distinctions between people who live boundaried lives and protean lives. Okay, a boundaried life is one where we put up walls and we define our life by what we screen out, by what we're against, by what we're frightened by what we want to have power over. Is that the kind of shape that my life has? Is it one that is determined by its boundaries? And are the boundaries the most important things about me? Another way he comes at the idea of who are we is to say that we could be protean people. They're the opposite of boundary people. Proteus was this mythological figure who could change his form and shape almost willy-nilly. I'd rather use the image of an amoeba, that every time there's a stimulus, the amoeba changes its shape. It adapts. Is that the kind of shape that our lives take? Many people say that that's the modern reality, is that we are so bombarded by stimuli that we constantly are adapting and changing who we are. A sociologist named Peter Berger talks about the idea that we are involved in an ongoing process of bricolage. And for that, he uses the image of putting tinker toys together. And so what we do is, today, I will take the pieces of my tinker toy set, my life, and I'll put them together this way. And then I'll just leave that alone until I have some kind of challenge or problem. And then I'll rearrange the pieces again, maybe because I've been given a new one, or maybe because an old one broke. So we're constantly constructing our life, like that tinker toy set. A third possibility, other than the boundary life or the protean life, is the possibility that we live a centered life. And that's really a way of coming back to the thread question. Is there a center to your life? And does everything sort of cohere in that or relate to that? Or is our life uncentered? Or perhaps, if you're like me, there are times when your life may be all of the above. Maybe there's a period in your life when you are more determined by the boundaries. Maybe another time in your life when it's much more protean. And then perhaps there are those moments, or those perhaps long chunks of time, when you actually can look at it and say, yes, there was a center, or there is a center too. All right, fourth question. I only have two more. Where are you headed? Or to ask it another way, what's your destination? An exercise that I hate, therefore I won't put you through it, is to ask people to divide up into twos and say, all right, and you have to do this with somebody you don't know, and to say, all right, in the next half an hour, your job is to construct for each other a life plan. Okay, I've been through this, okay, and it's supposed to be an icebreaker, I guess, but it also can be maddening, because all of a sudden you're just trying real hard to quickly impose a structure on a life that you know nothing about. But anyway, even if you don't want to do the exercise, if someone asks you to sketch the plan that you have for the next 1 year of your life, for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years, what would it look like? Where are you heading? All right, the fifth question. How do we go about discerning or discovering our vocations? I find that when I really take these kinds of questions seriously, I often find myself uncertain. And so the question then becomes, is there a process, or are there ways in which one can think about this topic that are more helpful than others? And I'm going to try to suggest at least parts of what I think can help that process along as we think together in our four sessions, if we all stay together here. I'm going to just give you a couple of minutes to mull these. And then we're going to go on to look at a biblical text. But I really don't think that we can exhaust them now, so I'm not going to try. But let's just kind of sit for a minute and think about our answers to those, or whatever these questions evoke in you. I don't know what your capacities for silence are. And I'm not going to stretch that too far. And I promise I won't do that long silence to you again. You're going to have to find your own silences throughout the rest of the week. But what I wanted to do there was to sort of imprint these questions just a bit in your consciousness, and also to think about maybe opening a path for you in your thinking that you may choose to follow later on. My sense about how a good teaching situation works is that most of the really great teaching goes on after the class is over. When people talk to each other, when they think back over something, and when that idea then takes them somewhere. And so I'm hoping that in conversations that we can have in much more informal ways, these ideas can be explored a bit more. What I'd like to do now is look at a biblical text with you. Now, do not turn this paper over, because there's a test. Actually, it's a very interesting story that once you start reading it, you will get swayed, and I don't want you to look at that until later on. But just look at the text from the Gospel of St. Mark. We've got some we need to hand upstairs here, too. Can I just get, how many are up there? Two? Two? Does everybody have one? I'm going to take now the idea that I had sketched before and explore it by looking at a biblical text. I want to tell you right now that what I'm going to do with this biblical text is something that I didn't cook up on my own. I learned about this way of looking at the text from a friend of mine named Parker Palmer, who wrote a book called The Active Life, and there's at least one copy of it over in the store. But I also want you to know that I'm not doing exactly what Parker Palmer did. He kind of gave me the idea, and I'm twisting it. And what that means is that whatever you don't like in what I'm about to do with this text, that's what Parker did. Whatever you like, that's what I did.
Okay. Makes sense.
Now, I'm going to suggest that we read this through, and then we'll talk about it a little bit and see where it takes us. But what I want you to note is that I'm taking a story from the Gospels that really does not talk about forgiveness per se. There is no mention of that word in this text. But what I wonder is if it may not teach us something about forgiveness nonetheless. So let's just read it together. I'll read it out loud to you. I'll try not to stop too often as we go through it, but just let the narrative have its own power. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while." Now here I do have to interrupt and say that may be what we all thought we were doing when we came to Holden. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. I sort of thought what it would be like to get off of the bus here and find all the people you thought you were getting away from sitting there, waiting. As he went ashore, he saw a great crowd. And he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy something for themselves to eat. But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." When they had found out, they said, "Five and 2 fish." Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and of fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them, and all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000. I want to ask you now to, if you can, suspend the normal way that you think about this text, about what was going on in it, and try to see if you could look at it as if you were hearing it for the first time, or reading it for the first time. And let me ask you, just when you look at the text, what do you see? What do you hear here? What strikes you as important?
Compassion.
Compassion. What else?
Not believing in the obvious. Believing that there could be something better.
Where do you see that in the text?
Well,
she was lucky. She picked a word that was right there. So you're picking an idea.
Okay. In other words, you're not looking for what I said, or you want me to just...
No, I am. I want you to say what you you see. Where did you see that, or how did that come to you?
Well, the disciples were limited by what they believed could happen from what they're used to. And the new idea was presented as a possibility, and it actually came into fruition.
What was
you
the new idea?
You give them something to eat.
Pardon?
I think the crux of it was you give them something to eat. Disciples were thinking, we got to go out and buy some food. Said, no, you give it to them.
Okay.
And that was the breakthrough.
Is that what you thought the new idea was?
No. I thought the new idea was that there was an act of faith that if they believed that they could have what they wanted, they could have it. That they wouldn't have to believe in the illusion of the appearance, that there could be more, to judge by righteous judgment, maybe, rather than the appearance of what seemed to be on a material level possible. That there could be a divine intervention, and something better could happen if only they believed.
Okay, so you see that the burden here is on the disciples having to believe something that apparently they don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And if they could believe it, it would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that how it works in this text? Do the disciples get converted to a new way of believing, and then does it happen?
It doesn't really say. You don't know.
There's an awful lot we don't know here. There's an awful lot that we have that we read in to the text. I'm trying to see both what we do read in and also if we can open ourselves to maybe...
Like Jesus tells the disciples to do something and they can only think of one way that the task can be done, and they can't do that.
Okay, so there's the problem of a routine or a habit of mind here.
I think the thing that strikes me about this, maybe thinking about it in terms of vocation, is that they didn't, Jesus didn't go there, nor did his disciples go there to feed people. They went there to get away from people, and they got stuck with it. This wasn't part of the plan that they had for that day, and they got roped into doing something here they had no intention of getting into. It was a pain in the neck to them.
And in fact, maybe they were themselves escaping to eat, you know, because it says no leisure even to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And they became the feeders, not the eaters.
Okay, something is going on here between Jesus and the disciples, and also between Jesus and the crowd. There's actually two sets of transactions at least. Maybe there's more. And we need to focus a little bit on what's going on between Jesus and the disciples first, and then we'll turn to Jesus in the crowd.
I think it's interesting that it starts out with the debriefing. They're telling Jesus all the things they've been doing and teaching, and then they're going to be rewarded with vacation, and they end up being, what do they call it here,
waitress.
And here they had this really big thing where they've gone out. And
well, it is interesting, isn't it? Those of you who are experts on the Gospel of St. Mark, anybody know where they were coming back from? They had just
been set up.
Okay, and they'd sort of known what they were supposed to do, and they'd gone out and done it. And I suspect, watch out here, because this could be a reading in, but let me ham it up a bit. Their home, full of a great deal of excitement, because they'd been out there and they'd done it. And maybe it had even worked, whatever they had been sent out there to do. And so they were maybe starting to think, you know, this discipleship thing, we've got it. We're beginning to get clear what it is that we are about, and we actually might even like seeing ourselves do that role. At any rate, they're debriefing. Now, maybe they're also talking about some of the disappointments and hassles that they had along the way. Notice how Jesus responds. He says, let's go to a deserted place and let's rest. And they all seem to think that's a very good idea. They may have been hungry. They definitely were tired. Maybe they were really at the end of their capacity to do more work. And so they had an expectation that there was a certain way that life ought to go, and now was the time that we ought to be able to rest. And of course, the surprise comes when the crowd actually gets around the lake before the boat crosses. I always wonder now exactly how that happened, and it would be fun to see that one acted out in some way. But at any rate, the crowd figured out where they were heading, made a mad dash around the lake, got there and said, here we are. And the disciples, what did they think about this?
They were a little put out.
That didn't say what the disciples' reactions
were.
That's
right.
What Christ's reaction was.
All right, what's Christ's reaction?
He had compassion on them. And here they are, burned out and stressed out, and yet he is compassionate and still giving.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the disciples have to go along with it, whether they had liked or not. But yet he had compassion on his disciples at the same time, and there, even as he was teaching them about this, you know, solving the food problem, he didn't degrade them in any way. He just kind of walked them through it all, and, you know, did a quiet miracle in front of them. But his compassion on their lack of ability to see past the physical realities.
Okay, so we encounter Jesus here sort of reaching down and finding some reservoir of compassion, and drawing upon it, and he begins to go to work doing what Jesus often did, and that is to sit down and teach. Now, it's interesting that the teaching that he did that we normally think of teaching, you know, the words, are not in this text at all, are they? They're sort of skipped over. maybe because there's a bigger lesson in the text than there might have been in this text as we have it, than there might have been in the words that he spoke. But how do the disciples feel about this compassion?
Impatient.
Okay.
They're kind of there tapping their toe, crossing their arms, looking at their watches, and when they're going to go home.
Yeah, getting hungrier, tireder. Any other feelings that they might have had?
I thought we came out here for us to rest. What are these people doing here?
Okay.
It's a statement of responsibility. That's it. We got to disperse these people because we're delaying them from taking care of their own needs.
So maybe the disciples weren't quite as just merely self-centered as we think. Maybe they were trying to be responsible.
I seem to say, Jesus, be practical.
Now this begins to sound like maybe these folks are a bit more Madison Avenue-ish than we thought. Mm-hmm. They're starting to think, now, Jesus, you've got a certain reputation. And this could go against that reputation. If we get this crowd out here and they're beginning to expect more and more and to enjoy it more and more, and all of a sudden it ends with a fizzle. What about that? All right. I want to move a little closer now to what's really going on in the disciples' response. What do they want to do first?
Well, it says they want to send away. Send them away.
Okay, the hour is late. Send them away. Why?
So that they can.
Okay, so that they can go and buy something for themselves to eat. Let's play with that sentence just a little bit. Because what I want to begin to draw a contrast in, and this is Parker's idea here, is the difference between an economics of scarcity and an economics of abundance. What I see going on and what Parker saw before I saw is that these disciples were really operating with a set of assumptions that this world does not have enough. And therefore, we can't solve the problem of all those hungry people. And therefore, rather than that become our problem, let's stay in a kind of mode of being which allows every person to solve their own problem. And so, let's send the problem away. Let's send these people out. Let them find the money rather than us dig deep and spend 200 denarii. So they want to disperse. There's not enough to go around. But what does Jesus say? You give them something to eat. Notice how powerful the economics of scarcity really can be. They don't believe for a moment it's possible. Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? Then what does Jesus do? How much do you have? It's a remarkable question, because what he's really saying is, instead of seeing yourselves as having nothing, why don't you see what in fact you really do have? He begins here as a good teacher. He's kind of exposed already how they think. Now he's beginning to expose something else to them. Maybe you've got more than you thought. He's beginning to reveal their giftedness, not just their poverty. So he says, how many do you have? They go and see. When they found out, again, the economics of scarcity is still kind of at work. You can see them, you know, going out there and searching through all their backpacks and all of that, and finding, shoot, here's all we've got, 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Then Jesus takes his teaching another step ahead. He's identified that you've got something. But again, rather than looking at that as it's not enough, he goes to work with it. He takes that little meager bit and begins to do something. And so what does he do first? Well, you thought the small group movement was organized in the 1950s and 60s. Au contraire. It was something that Jesus was quite comfortable doing a long, long time ago. He divides the people up into groups of 50 and 100. What he's beginning to do here is take a mass, a crowd, and turn it into a community. Creating community in their midst. So he breaks them up, makes them more intimate, more face-to-face, begins to make possible a different way of being for them. And then he goes on, he takes those loaves and the fish, and in essence, he has the courage to take those little things and to stand up in front of the whole group of people and to offer it. And the first thing he does is he offers it to God. And then he offers it to them. Now I want to suggest to you that that's a remarkable creative act, but a very daring and costly one, to stand in front of a crowd with a little bit, with something that looks like it's very inadequate for all of the needs that are out there. But to go ahead and stand there and offer it. And what the text unfolds for us is that that act of offering releases something. It sets something in motion. It begins to free. What does it release? Well, here, and this is probably the part that I want you to blame Parker for, okay, is what if that whole crowd had in there, you know, big flowing robes? All kinds of salami sandwiches and peanut butter and jelly and all kinds of food, but it was all individualized. What if they all had brought some stuff with them because they'd been out there for the day? Maybe a few hadn't been that good at their planning, but there was all kinds of stuff that nobody was bringing forth. And what if when Jesus stands up and offers this little bit, what if that releases in those people who look at him the freedom to say, oh yeah, I've got something too. And if all of a sudden what is released, and this is a different way of reading this miracle account, that instead of Jesus sort of doing magic over the five loaves and the two fish, what he does is he changes the people. And that his creative work of building a community and of offering a gift, of standing there in front of all of those folks with those huge expectations, holding that up there, if that allows them to be different kinds of people. Maybe what he does here is create room. Maybe this is the kind of teacher he is and the kind of Lord he is. That he creates a possibility, a capacity, a space where people can be very different. Now, let's not run away from that act of Jesus standing up and offering. Because what that does is it helps us see what I would argue is sort of the first motion in the process of forgiveness. It is that daring freedom to stand before people as you really are. And what Jesus does is he stands before God as he really is, with just that little bit, and offers it. And the gift that comes is that that's enough. And that begins to set some things in motion. Now what I want to suggest there is that what Jesus does after he looks up to heaven, blesses and breaks the loaves, is that he is in that whole effort reorganizing life around the forgiveness of sins. He began that work with that first instance of compassion. And he continues it through this whole account. Again, there's no language here about forgiveness. But there's a sense in which he accepts this group of people, these disciples, this hungry crowd, He accepts them as they are. He accepts them with what little they have. And he works with it. He takes it upon himself and does something with it. He takes their brokenness for what it is, their inadequacy for what it is, their self-doubt, their all their assumptions about the economics of scarcity. He takes that all on, and then he releases something else in the midst of it all. Now the rest of this account tells us that all ate and were filled. I think in the original language here, a better way to say it is that they were satisfied. I don't know that they all went away like we did after last evening's dinner, completely stuffed and able to eat maybe no more. But they went away satisfied. They had experienced something that satisfied. They had experienced a form of community, an offering that was unexpected and that was freeing. They had also experienced the capacity to be something different than what they were when they went out that morning. So the text says that they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who had eaten numbered 5,000. I don't know quite what to do with that last word there. You noticed I skipped over it the first time. Whether there were a lot of other folks out there that they didn't count, maybe there were 8,000. Or maybe there were 5,000, and that word men is intended to include them all. We don't know how many there really were. But what we know is that they experienced with Jesus something that sent them away whole. Now that's a different way, perhaps, of talking about the text, and I want you now to have ample freedom to take and just dump on Parker Palmer since he's not here. Let's talk about that a little bit. What strikes you in that way of entering the world of this text? What might that have to do with vocation?
It occurs to me that Christ was sort of, Jesus was acting as a role model, that people said, I want to behave like that. And so they did. And it occurs to me that we don't have many contemporary role models where, or we don't share with our children. I want you to see this person because I want you to grow up like them. We're much more interested in facts and figures and getting ahead than in projecting role models for ourselves to follow or for our families to use.
What do you see in this role model? Let's begin to kind of identify some things that make Jesus so different here. Maybe there are clues there for our own thinking about our own vocation.
He's a risk taker who's willing to share.
Okay. This is an individual who has a certain kind of courage, kind of freedom, and he gives a lot away. Well, remember that what he shared wasn't his own. There was all, I mean, even part more of his audacity here is he took other people's stuff and did something with it.
But it was what he had to eat too.
Yes.
And he did share. He shared his time. I mean, he could have sent them away right at the beginning.
Absolutely. There's a French word that Gabriel Marcel uses for a virtue that I think Jesus embodies here in this text. The French word is disponibilité. And what I understand that word to mean is interruptibility. This is a remarkably ad hoc image of Jesus. You'd think that he would have stayed with the task of helping those disciples debrief and learn from their own experience. And you think that he would have honored the idea of Sabbath and rest. And instead what happens here is he has the freedom to respond to the neighbor that comes. And in that responding, even though it looks like it's a detour and it looks like it's going to be a grand disappointment, it becomes a way of teaching something even greater and of offering something even greater than what they had before, what they would have had had they stayed on track. Any other?
Well, one thing that strikes me, which strikes me a lot in all the teachings like this, why does Jesus leave it to us to make these interpretations? Why wasn't it made more clear on all the parables and various stories as to what these mean? Why was it just told in a parable and then left for us to guess at, which meant many interpretations were going to happen? Boy, do they ever.
What do you think?
No thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I could use help here.
Well, I think the process of trying to think that through is healthy. And, you know, and interpreting and studying like we're doing now.
It draws us together.
Yeah.
It's like a child problem solving. They, if you tell them how to do it, they don't really learn how to do it. And then by doing, I teach horseback riding, I refuse to help them. You know, I will coach a little bit, but the process of them ingrains it into them immensely. And there's joy in that process of learning, and it's just instilled so much that, I don't know, I find the same joy in searching for the truth and finding that out. And the ups and downs along the way are confusing at times, but it's okay.
Maybe what Jesus wants us to learn is something that if we had it all, point one, point two, point three, point four, point five, we really wouldn't get it. And maybe what it is that Jesus wants us to get is a discovery of some things, and that we have to enter into that journey and that discovery ourselves. And the wonderful thing is that he draws us in, he invites us in. There's a sense in which each time you come at a text, there's more there. There's an inexhaustibleness to these texts. And that's what I like so much about Parker's interpretation. I'm not sure that I will always look at it just the way Parker did. But I saw something in the text through his eyes that I had not seen before. He helped me see more clearly what kind of leader and teacher Jesus was. That doesn't mean that he's exhausted the text at all. But he helps me see dimensions of what we call a miracle here that I had not seen before. Now, let's go a little farther with that. What all does he teach us? And what all do we begin to encounter in this text? Well, it probably won't surprise you that I'm going to say that he helps us see the law of God here. And we see it in a whole lot of ways. We see a powerful example of what it means to love the neighbor in this text. And here the neighbor is not just the person that you know, it's that crowd that comes at you with needs. We also see a remarkable example of love of God in Jesus. We see that standing there and that offering. So in essence, Jesus is embodying here both of the tables of the law, loving of God, loving of neighbor. We see it at work in the text. But that's not all we see about the law, because this is a powerful diagnosis of our condition as well. This is a text about human need, and the need is enormous. There's a need to eat. There's a need to learn. There's a need to have community. There's a need to become free of this economics of scarcity. One of the great problems that Jesus is helping us see as he works through this experience with this group of people is that we approach life with a fundamental set of assumptions that there really isn't enough to go around. And we live again and again that way, and so we do all kinds of things to protect ourselves. Maybe we do it through putting up boundaries around ourselves that can screen out the neighbor, or at least limit access of the neighbor to us. And you know, the openness of Jesus here is remarkable. I mean, he's just wide open for anybody. And so we begin to see our need, we begin to see how much we resist facing that need. These disciples did not want to get out of their economics of scarcity at all. They wanted to stay right in there, they wanted to send the people home. Jesus refused to let them do that. This is accusation. This is saying, disciples, you do not understand what I am about. Disciples, you are off track. Disciples, you are at odds with the law of God. You're not loving the neighbor. You're not loving God. But I also see in this text that Jesus is embodying. And again, isn't it odd that we really don't get that much talk from Jesus? We get certain directions, but we get actions here from him. Jesus both models a different way. So there are the idea of him being, you know, this example that we really need and wish that there were more. But also Jesus gives us something. There is an offering. There is a new creation that is going on in this text. He releases human beings from that scarcity, from that assumption that there's not enough, that we're not going to make it, that it's everybody for him or herself. And instead, he says, look what you can do with the gifts that have been given. And look at how much can happen if those gifts are released. And he begins to reorder the giftedness of all those people and let them turn it for the love of neighbor and for the love of God. What's going on here is the defeat of the economics of scarcity by the economics of abundance. There is enough for us all. That's the message of the text. Now, this is only, we're at the point where we need to stop. This is only one instance in a whole ministry of reordering life around the forgiveness of sins. And I guess if I could use an image from the state of Washington, I saw Mount St. Helens for the first time just a couple of days ago. I was struck by the warning signs that preceded that grand eruption. What I see going on in this miracle story, in Jesus' teaching, those are the early warning signs of something that is going to be released very powerfully. The eruption of this, the tremendous just unleashing of it, occurs at the cross and at the tomb. That's where the new creation, the whole reordering of life around the forgiveness of sins, really takes place. What Jesus does is he breaks through. He breaks through to community. He breaks through to abundance. He offers grace. And that's where we need to stop today. Now, if you'll turn your document over. I know that there are many wonderful things to do here, and maybe you don't want to read this text, and it's not mandatory. I will, in our next session, summarize what's here. But those of you who have some time, this is a modern snapshot of the need for this kind of reordering. And I invite you to read it if you wish. If you know you're not going to, rather than just toss it, let me have the papers back, okay? But it's here for you if you wish to take it with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's very nice to have you.